If this is Friday, that must mean a White House shakeup. Oh, look, it is. This one with maybe some actual economic after effects from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 18th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Chief Strategist Steve Bannon is out of a job at the White House, as you have surely heard by now. He joins Sean Spicer and writes Priebus in the Trump administration's developing tradition of Friday departures. This one, though, brings with it, depending on how you look at it, the potential for some economic policy stability, or at the very least, the prospect of said stability. Rachel Abrams is at the New York Times. Cardiff Garcia is at the blog FT Alphaville. They are both in our studio in New York to wrap up the 5 days gone by. Hey, everybody.
Hey there.
Hey, Kat.
So, Cardiff, let me go to you for a second first. Take me back to yesterday. The rumor was that Gary Cohn, the president's chief of the National Economic Council, was going to be on his way out. Markets did not care for that very much at all. What do you make of today's news?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it looks like a bit of a political whiplash where you had somebody who's thought to be very pro-business and also a more globalist presence within the White House who might have been on his way out because he was disgusted from earlier this week, reportedly, by Trump's comments. And then today it turns out that it looks like Cohn is staying, and instead it's Stephen Bannon who is leaving. And so to the extent that the more isolationist wing of the White House has lost some power, it could be reflected in markets. That could be something that's priced in. On the other hand, Donald Trump has not exactly shown himself to be very susceptible to the compositional changes of who's in the White House. I mean, if anything, he seems to have a kind of autoimmune reaction to the people who surround him because he hates the possibility that people will think he's being influenced or that he's being, that he's not responsible for what he does. And so I think there's a lot about this that's uncertain. But sure, it's not crazy to think that markets had a favorable reaction to what happened today.
What do you think, though, Rachel, what this might mean for the broader economic agenda, tax reform, infrastructure, those things that Bannon, you know, had some differing views from Gary Cohn and much of mainstream economic thought on?
Well, it's really hard to speculate considering how difficult getting anything done, getting anything through Congress has been. And especially as it comes to tax policy, we don't even have a tax proposal written yet, and it keeps getting pushed off. It was originally supposed to be this summer, and now maybe there's talk of the fall. But I think that Steve Bannon, some of his ideas were not as popular within the Republican Party as perhaps others. There were a few stories about how he'd actually pushed for, and maybe others, but we know that he at one point might have pushed for taxes on the super wealthy as part of a tax reform package. And that obviously is not something that has a ton of support with mainstream Republicans. So Gary Cohn obviously represents a much more established strain of thought. And so in that sense, he might actually be more aligned with Republicans that might have any kind of momentum to get something done.
Yeah. Cardiff, can we go back to Tuesday, that press conference and the fallout from it, specifically the disbanding, the dissolution, the disintegration of the president's strategy council and his manufacturing council? One of the reasons the CEOs gave for staying on those councils was that they had to be at the table to influence policy. Do you buy that?
No. In one
All
word.
Right, thanks very much for coming on.
I take it you want a little bit more than that.
A little bit.
Look, they'll still have influence. That influence is obviously dictated by the extent to which Donald Trump is willing to listen to them and whether or not right now at least he gives them a call. But I think what's really fascinating about this is that we spend a lot of time wondering if big companies and big company CEOs have too much influence over the political process. In this case, it was the company's CEOs themselves that have shown themselves to be vulnerable to widespread public condemnation of what's happening to the extent that they had to disassociate themselves from a president that, frankly, they ought to have a lot that they agree on because he is supposed to be a deregulatory president.
Right.
He's supposed to be a lower tax president. And yet he can't keep them, in line.
So, Rachel, we talked about this a little bit on Wednesday, you and I, when we had you on, when those councils disbanded. Let me run another theory by you. Now that the president has alienated corporate America and he has alienated many, if not most, of the Republicans in Congress by his remarks on Tuesday, even though they might not say that out loud, What do you make of the theory that the GOP in Congress and corporate America might work together on things like tax reform and infrastructure, with the White House having to pry its way in from the outside?
Companies want tax reform. They want to lower corporate tax rate. And I think that these executives are going to do whatever it is that they need to do to get that done that's possible. I think that certainly the GOP needs a big legislative win right now. They need to show that they can get something done. And if they have to work with business leaders to help shape an agenda that has any chance of passing, I think they're talking about around Thanksgiving. I think that there are people that have some kind of momentum and incentive to get that done. Republicans in Congress need to show that they can get something passed before the midterm elections. And if they have to move ahead without the president, I imagine that there are going to be a lot of people that are willing to do that.
Rachel Abrams at the New York Times, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville, and our tiny little studios in New York. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, a little bit bumpy, courtesy of the Bannon News. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So as Rachel and Cardiff and I were talking about, and actually they might have been in the big room in New York. I don't know. Could have been in the small room, big room. I don't know. Anyway, Steve Bannon is out at the White House, which means, in theory anyway, that the odds of a trade war with China are at least a little bit lower today than they were yesterday, which is good because for all the real economic competition between the United States and China, the two economies need each other. To that end, Beijing put out some new rules on overseas investments today, specifically limits on certain kinds of foreign acquisitions by Chinese companies, everything from real estate to hotels and entertainment. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that one.
For companies doing business with China, today's announcement didn't really come as a surprise.
It's just codifying guidance that they've already been delivering to Chinese companies for quite some time now.
Andy Rothman is an investment strategist at Matthews Asia. He says overall investment by China has dropped off from the beginning of the year.
But let's put that in context. That outbound investment's been growing a lot in recent years. So the numbers are still pretty big. And I think we're going to see a pullback for a year or two until companies adjust.
The rules could hurt investment in things like hotels, the entertainment industry, real estate, and sports. But Brookings economist David Dollar says he doesn't see the wider U.S. economy being impacted that much.
I don't think it has huge implications for the U.S. They invested about $20 billion in the U.S. last year. It's the biggest destination for the Chinese investment. I expect that to continue.
However, he says some U.S. regional markets who have benefited from China's real estate spending spree may feel the pain more.
Chinese have invested a lot in San Francisco and some other California areas. So it's possible there that this will have a noticeable effect on the real estate market.
Ethan Kramer Flood is with the Conference Board, a business and research organization. He says China will keep pursuing advanced manufacturing technologies in things like semiconductors and artificial intelligence.
But also, you know, agriculture and energy. And I mean, there's plenty of other stuff. Plenty of other areas where we're going to see probably business keep right on going.
Kramer Flood says China will also encourage companies to push money into projects related to its Belt and Road infrastructure project. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
A quick insert here, since the solar eclipse will have come and gone by the time you next hear from us. Got a press release from the American Trucking Association today pointing out that there are way more cars and trucks on the road since the last time there was a total eclipse visible from the continental United States. And distracted driving, don't even get them started. Moral of the story, if you are driving someplace on Monday, be careful out there, will you? All right, today's lesson in the lasting accuracy of the law of supply and demand comes to us from the maritime shipping industry. Cargo rates for those giant container ships are going up because volume is up and thus shipping space is getting tight. Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains what's going on there.
Tons of cargo moves around the globe in big secured containers stacked onto huge ships, everything from furniture, bananas, shoes, to auto parts. Paul Bingham is a trade and logistics expert with the Economic Development Research Group, and he says carriers' vessels have gotten ever larger in recent years.
They were chasing a low cost of operation temptation, where they had the theory that by buying larger ships than their competitors, they could have lower unit costs of carrying the boxes.
Some vessels carry as many as 20,000 containers. demand for container ships cratered around the time of the recession, according to Jim Blazer in the maritime practice at the consulting firm Alex Partners. He says between 2007 and 2008,
demand declined, I think, globally for global trade, 10 or 15%.
And though global trade crept back slowly, carriers overestimated its resurgence, ordering too many vessels that were too large. A major carrier declared bankruptcy last year as freight rates tanked.
The rate environment that we saw last year was really historically low, right? I mean, the idea that you could move a container from the port of Shanghai to the port of Los Angeles, in many cases for less than $1,000, is a pretty remarkable thing.
But now Blazer says freight rates are climbing 20 to 50% over the year, depending on the location and company. Carriers have slowed their ship orders, old vessels are getting scrapped, and trade and logistics expert Paul Bingham says carriers have consolidated.
There's basically now three large groups of companies that coordinate their schedules and their shipping.
Bingham says the industry is probably still losing money, but not as much as last year. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Public housing has been controversial for a long time, longer perhaps than you might have thought. Back during the Great Depression, 80-something years ago, the federal government tried something a little bit different, designing and building entire towns that were federally planned and subsidized. Greenbelt towns, they were called. Three of them were built before politics and economics got in the way, but those three do still stand. Photographer Jason Roblando has a book coming out about the Greenbelt towns. It's called New Deal Utopias. Jason, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
How did you find these Greenbelt towns?
I first started photographing public housing in Chicago. I was photographing the high rises on the south side, and I eventually found out about another public housing complex on the north side of Chicago called Lathrop Homes. It was very idyllic, and it had lush green courtyards. I found out that it was built in this Garden City style. And when I learned about that, I learned that it was developed by this Englishman named Sir Ebenezer Howard. And his idea was to combine the best of the town and best of the country, meaning the social and economic advantages of living in community with each other, with the fresh air and open green spaces of nature. So those Garden City principles were applied to the Greenbelt towns, and the towns are located in Greenbelt, Maryland, Green Hills, Ohio, and Greendale, Wisconsin.
Tell me about them. When you go to them today, can you tell that they were planned and organized and sort of, built as these community centers?
Absolutely. I mean, the first time I had visited them, you cross the border, and I was just stunned. I really felt like I was in a different time.
Huh.
And they were, kind of these small, modest houses, and they looked like they were from England. They had these also lush courtyards, common green spaces, and they were conceived in 1935, and they were conceived as a solution to the Great Depression. So the idea was it was a job creation program, but also a housing program.
They only lasted, it should be said, 18-ish years, right? By 1952, there was the whole communist thing, and people were upset about the idea of communal living and communal cooperation. But also they were expensive.
Yes, they were controversial from the start as far as cost overruns and also the communal cooperative aspect that was kind of built into it. So by the 50s, they were transferred to private developers and homeowners. And I think that was probably a good thing as far as not having the government be the landlord forever. Hmm. I think people feel real ownership of the community.
When you talk to the people who live there, what's the sense?
They can't hide their Greenbelt pride. People really love living there, particularly the people that I met in Greenbelt, Maryland. They are still living in a cooperative model. So if your neighbor's roof needs fixing, it comes out of this communal pot. So it's kind of like a, you know, it is cooperative.
But you can't just do any kind of roof you like, right? I mean, with the money come the rules.
Precisely. So there are committees. I think that's all within the kind of auspices of historic preservation and preserving the character of the place. And that's another way that people stay connected to the New Deal. Mm-hmm.
Jason Robledo is a photographer. His book about these greenbelt cities and a bunch of other places is called New Deal Utopias. And we've got some pictures and a bunch of links on our website as well, marketplace.org. Jason, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Coming up.
I'm a coal miner's daughter, sister, and a wife three times over.
There's a country song in there somewhere. Coal country is counting on better times. Straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 76 points today, 0.3%, 21,674. The NASDAQ down 5, less than 0.1%, 62,16. S&P 500 lost about 4 points, 0.1%, 24,025. For the week, the Dow off 0.8%. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 each gave back about 0.6%, virtually all of that yesterday, as we were talking about earlier. Beauty products firm Estee Lauder slapped on 7.7% today as sales and profits beat expectations. Company stores in China and Italy did especially well. Disappointing results today, though, for heavy equipment maker Deere. Its stock dug down 5.3% on lower than predicted sales. Applied Materials put on 2.7% as it posted third quarter results that beat estimates. Bond price is pretty much flat. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note is at 2.19%. And you, yeah, you, right there, you. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Last we looked, which, of course, we do every month, the unemployment rate in this country was 4.3%. Low by any measure, crazy low by historical standards. But as good as that is, it's only part of the labor market picture. One of the other things helpful to look at is something called the labor force participation rate, the slice of people in this economy with or actively looking for work. And that rate has been stuck near a relatively low, and not in a good way low, 63% for years now. And it turns out it's mainly a guy thing. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains.
In 2014, Sita Sundaresan left a high-level job at an investment bank after an injury. A few months ago, she decided it was time to go back. So she launched a job search from her New York apartment.
I'm getting calls. People are talking to me. So that's very encouraging.
Sundaresan is among the growing number of women aged 25 to 54 who've started working or looking for work in the last 2 years. What's driving the change? Of the fastest growing jobs,
7 out of the top 10 are female-dominated jobs.
Dana Britton directs the Center for Women and Work at Rutgers University. She says few of those jobs are at Sundaresan's level. Most are in healthcare, home health aides, medical and nursing assistants. And she says pay-wise, they're not great.
If you average together the salaries for all of those 7 jobs that are female-dominated, the average comes out to about $35,000 a year.
But were it not for women, the labor participation rate, already a low 62.9%, would be even lower, says Diana Furchgott-Roth, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute.
So we've seen a movement into the labor force of women at the same time as out of the labor force of men.
Furchgott-Roth says men still dominate the workforce, but not as much as they did before the Great Recession, when millions of manufacturing jobs were lost.
It's much harder to get back into those kinds of areas. It's much harder to retrain.
So she says many of those men gave up looking and never came back. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Remember how President Trump promised during the campaign that he was going to bring back the American coal industry? Well, don't look now, but exports of what's called thermal coal, the kind used in power generating plants, rose 58% in the first quarter of this year. However, analysts figure this is more really of a blip than a boom, and that coal in the long term looks pretty bleak as cheaper natural gas and renewables gain ground in the energy market. On the ground, though, In the coal fields, with Trump in the White House, miners are feeling better than they have in a while. Dan Boyce from the public media newsroom Inside Energy went to Western Colorado to hear one miner story.
11 o'clock on a Friday night, and the West Elk Mine opens its gates. A dozen or so cars and trucks start rolling out. Don Staley's freshly showered in a Denver Broncos ball cap. He's reached the end of his shift, the end of a long stretch with no days off.
Yeah, this is 26 today. Straight days.
Miners have been opening up a new section underground.
Well, we didn't have the manpower.
The economics of the coal industry today means mining companies take on fewer workers. Those who get jobs have to put in longer hours to do whatever needs to be done. The area's lost more than 700 mining jobs since 2010. Saturday.
Grab some Gatorade.
Finally, a day off. Don's got to catch up on errands.
I need to get a little bit of yogurt.
Groceries.
Maybe some hot dog buns.
Don is 39, and he's lived in this valley basically his whole life. So he has connections to pretty much everything, even the store we're in.
When I was younger, I worked here. This is what I did when I was in high school.
I was a great employee. Listened well.
Brad Holt is co-owner of the market, which has been in his family here in the town of Paonia since the 1930s. He says for decades, the mines gave locals lots of stable, high-paying jobs. Don makes almost $100,000 a year working at West Elk. But jobs like his are few and far between now, and Holt's grocery is feeling the pinch. Profits aren't what they were.
Well, I don't know if you call it profits. Sales are down from where they were, you know.
Paonia has been changing for a while now. Less of a coal town, more of a tourist destination. Organic farmers, coffee shops with cappuccino and yoga studios, that all brings its own benefits, but it doesn't bring in families to live here like the coal industry did. Up on a small hill overlooking Paonia sits the American Legion Post 97. Saturday night, it's time for a raffle. Tickets cost $1. They get tossed in this circular wooden cage that's getting hand-cranked around and around. Don's here.
I have 25 tickets.
None of them winners.
873. Miss
Jan! Bartender Pam Daugherty moved here in the 80s from Kentucky.
I'm a coal miner's daughter, sister, and a wife three times over.
She is not a fan of how Paonia is changing. Does it feel like your town anymore?
No, I don't go downtown. I do not shop here.
In the Legion, though, it feels like old times.
Yes, it does. It feels like this is ours.
There are a number of other miners in here along with Don, buying each other beers, joking around. Don says it's like a family. His blue eyes light up when he talks about what his industry contributes.
Every time you flip on a switch, every time you get to watch TV, that's what we give.
Coal still provides about a third of U.S. electricity, and mining it is physical, dangerous, and dirty work. And for Don, miles underground, completely cut off from the outside world, it can feel thankless. Yet now Don and his fellow miners have a stalwart booster, the President of the United States.
I mean, think about it. If you was beat down for 8 years or 10 years, when somebody has something good to say about you, you'd say, you know what, that's great.
Don feels like President Trump has been keeping his word to coal miners, working to roll back environmental regulations and increase mining on federal land. Don's own mine has recently made some modest hires. Taking it all into account, he and his buddies at the American Legion are almost optimistic. Tonight will be a late night. There are beers on the table. Then Sunday night, Don's back in the mine on his new shift, 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. for the next 2 weeks. I'm Dan Boyce for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a story of nature, plastic water bottles, and the revolving door in Washington, D.C. The National Park Service, reports the Washington Post, has ended a 6-year ban on plastic water bottles in some parks. The ban had been put in place to reduce waste, obviously, from the millions of visitors to those parks by obliging them to use reusable water bottles. The new Deputy Secretary of the Interior, of which the National Park Service is a part, we should say, to get to the revolving door part. Confirmed to that job just 3 weeks ago, he was. He was a lobbyist before he joined the government, representing Nestle, one of the largest water bottlers in the United States. All right, we are out of here. The Dow off 76 today, about 0.3%, 21,674 for the blue chips. NASDAQ down 5 points, less than a tenth, 62.16. The S&P 500 off 4, about a tenth percent, 24.25. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.